Well, we come to our final night of this gospel meeting, and like Joe, there are several things, many things that I would like to have the time to say this evening, but we are here for the preaching of the gospel, and I don't want to get caught up too much in some of the personal remarks, but I do want to express my deepest appreciation to each and every one of you once again for a wonderful week that I've been blessed to spend with you and in our work together. I always look forward to coming here, and admittedly, part of it is I just love the area up here. You're very blessed to live in such a beautiful area, and I enjoy all of God's beautiful creation that I'm able to see, but more than that, I enjoy the good company and just the fellowship that we're able to have together, the fact that we are so much of the same mind and of the same spirit. And it's tremendously encouraging to me. It's interesting to me to be in this part of the world where obviously there is a great deal of opposition to truth. There are so many people that are set on compromise, and that's certainly not limited to this part of the United States, but I think that we're very aware that there's a lot of liberal thought and liberal ideas, but I think it's just a beautiful thing that in the midst of all of that, there's a church like Mount Baker here that is holding up the banner and so fearless in the proclamation of the gospel. And I want to thank all of you, obviously Joe, for the wonderful work that he does and has done for so many years. I've been able to just rely on him to put so much good material out there and to always be preaching the truth. The website, and I know that Joe's not the only one that works with that, but Chuck and probably others are responsible for what is there. But I'm just so thankful for the material that's there that I can readily recommend to other preachers, to younger preachers, to members of the church, not just at Southside, but in many places, to be able to go there and to find good material, find things that they can search and listen to or read. It's a tremendous benefit. So I can't say enough about how much I appreciate the work that this church does, the work that Joe does in the gospel and holding up and sounding out the truth. That means more to me than maybe you can realize as a gospel preacher. Just know that there is a place like this here in the United States. And so each time I'm here with you, we just have this reunion again and enjoy getting to be together. It was special this year because Jennifer has been able to be here last night and tonight to get to meet many of you. She'll be able to put a face with names and people that I talk about. She'll be able to realize where I've been and where this church is, and she'll appreciate it even more now, and I'm thankful for that. You've had her and my kids in your prayers every time through these gospel meetings, and so now you're able to put a face with her. I haven't especially appreciated the fact that Linda and others have stated they thought she was my daughter, and I think that that's just a little extreme. I know she looks a lot younger than me, but no, I appreciate how wonderfully you've received her and how kind you've been, and I knew that you would be. And I would love for my children to be able to travel up here sometime and get to meet all of you and talk to them about it a lot. So I just have that deep affection and appreciation for all of you. The years that we've been able to work together have been wonderful. Unfortunately, this year has been the first year that I've been here without Shirley, and it has obviously been different. And it's been a time of joy for me to get to be with Dan and with everyone else here, but there is no doubt that there's a hole here, and that's just the way it is. And I know that that's a part of life. There are congregations. I know the church there at Pruitt and Lobet in Baytown, Dan goes back to visit many times, from the days when Dan and I first were getting to know each other when he was there at Baytown. There are a good number of brethren that we both have had such a deep affection and respect for. They're no longer there. And you just don't replace people like that. You don't replace Shirley. You don't, that's just a part of this life on this earth. But what we are able to do is to be reunited one day. And it's opportunities like this when we come together and worship and sing and have this fellowship that we realize how sweet that's going to be. And it's really what we're all working toward. That's the reason that we're having a series like this, is to exhort one another and to teach and instruct so that we can all be there in eternity in the end. So very thankful for the blessing that I've had through the years of always being able to stay with the Torres family. And I know that I'd be staying with Dan if things hadn't happened the way that they did, but it's still been a wonderful week. I know there's a lot more that I could say. I appreciate the wonderful song leaders, the good songs that you've led us in, and your tremendous prayers that you've offered up for my parents and all of my family through this week. I just can't tell you how much I appreciate it. The hospitality has always just been outstanding. So I'll be sad to be leaving you, but I'm looking forward to the next time, or to that eternal reunion that we'll all be able to have. So God bless you all for that. So as we come to the close of this series on conquering giants, we are going to be closing with a look at what the Bible refers to as the spirit of fear. The spirit of fear. When we think about this spirit of fear, I want to take you back to our text in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And I want to remind you where we read there in verse 8 that Goliath stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. In verse 24, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. This is the spirit of fear. This is the spirit of cowardice. But in verse 37 of that same chapter, we see the spirit of David. David said in verse 37, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." He was confident in the power of God. So in verse 45, he said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in heaven. And then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with the sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's. He will give you into our hands." And so it was, when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. That's the spirit of David. The spirit of fear, the spirit of David. We are to have that spirit of David, not the spirit of fear, but the spirit of power. I want you to notice with me in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, where we find our text in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and in verse 7. I want you to notice there where Paul said to Timothy, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." As we've been looking at this subject, this theme of conquering giants, what we've realized all throughout this study is that giants were always designed to intimidate God's people, to cause them to relinquish or to give up their commitment, to discourage them, to destroy their faith. And it's all about fear and the spirit of fear. And so as we're looking at this tonight, I want to look at this spirit of fear, if you will, as the spirit of Goliath itself. It is a giant in and of itself. How many of you have had that occasion where you have been terribly afraid? Maybe you have to go back to being a child to remember it, but wasn't that a miserable thing? To just be horribly scared. You know that we all go through that at various times in our life. Maybe we're a child and we're afraid of some bad guy or a monster under the bed or something like that. But as we grow up, there there comes to be other things that are just as frightening, if not more frightening, and they're probably more frightening because we know that they're real. But that being afraid is a terrible thing. But what we're noticing here is that Paul is telling Timothy that is not the spirit of Christ. That we need to have the spirit of power and of love and of a sound mind. Now that doesn't mean that Paul was never afraid. Certainly not. I want you to notice in Acts chapter 18 that when Paul came into Corinth, he tells us that in verse 9, the Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision. And here's what the Lord said to Paul in Acts 18 and verse 9. Do not be afraid, but speak and do not keep silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to hurt you, for I have many people in this city. Isn't that impressive? Why would the Lord need to tell Paul, do not be afraid? No one's going to attack you. I'll be with you. Why would he need to tell him that? It indicates to me that Paul was going through a time of at least a certain degree of fear. Here's a grown man that's preaching the gospel and he was afraid for his life. There must have been a certain level or measure of fear that he was going to be attacked, that he was going to be harmed. As a matter of fact, when you read 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul said in verse 3, I was with you, as he's writing to the Corinthians, I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. Yeah, he was going through some things there in Corinth. As a matter of fact, when he wrote his second letter, in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, he writes about this again. He says in verse 5, 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 5, for indeed when we came to Macedonia, our bodies had no rest, but we were troubled on every side. Outside were conflicts, inside were fears. You ever go through that? There are conflicts that you're dealing with, and inwardly, you're afraid. Afraid about how this is going to turn out. You're afraid about how you're going to respond. You're afraid about what might happen as a result of this. I tell you, if you've raised children to be beyond teenage years, then surely you've been afraid. There are just a lot of things out there that scare us. And it's not that Paul is saying that he was never afraid, but what he's saying is that the Spirit of Christ is a spirit of confidence. It is a spirit of power, and it involves this love and of a sound mind. That is healthy thinking. And I believe he's giving us here a key to conquering this giant of fear, the spirit of fear. And that is that sound mind. It is healthy thinking, the right perspective in all of these things. But the spirit of fear is, I believe, just as universal as the problem of materialism that we looked at last night, the various false doctrines that we've looked at. This is a prevalent problem. It's one that I've experienced myself. It's one that I have to be on the lookout for. That when I feel it creeping up and I feel those feelings of fear, I've got to go back to God's Word. I've got to spend more time in prayer. I need to petition the prayers of brethren. You know, just what you've been praying about regarding my dad. There are certain fears that I have about that. And thinking about my mom and going through it myself, and my kids and other things like that. You know how it is when if you've lost a loved one or you've gone through a time like that. There are just certain fears that go along with that. And it's in those times that with a sound mind you're able to rein it back in. And realize the promises that God gives us and to be able to have the proper perspective on it. But you know, if we're not careful, pretty soon we end up in that scary place again. And that's the reason we're having this study. Because this is a real thing. And it's not something that I'm trying to tell you that you need to be ashamed of. You know, there's some sins that carry with them a certain level of shame. And I realize that there's a certain sense in which we might tell a kid that's afraid of something, well, you know, you need to man up. You know, you need to get over that fear and toughen up a little bit or something like that. And we might need to encourage each other a little bit like that. But I'm not trying to make you feel ashamed if you're struggling with the spirit of fear, if you've battled it, or if it's something that comes back to visit every now and then. But what I do want you to realize is it's something that we all go through. It's something that we can confess one to another and seek the prayers of each other. And it's something that we can conquer. and something that we must conquer. That's really the message that I want you to be able to take home with you tonight as we close this meeting out, is that we're not going to conquer any of these giants if we can't conquer the spirit of fear. Because everything that we've looked at is going to have within it an element of fear. Satan designs these things in this very way. That's the whole point of a giant of great stature, is to strike fear in the hearts of people. So we've got to be able to overcome that. But when we talk about the spirit of fear, one of the things that we're looking at is the fear of man as opposed to the fear of God. And we see this going all the way back, and we use this verse to show the purpose of giants. But in Numbers chapter 13, remember that? Turn over there with me if you will. In Numbers chapter 13, remember when the children of Israel were poised to go into the land of Canaan? And they were there at on the banks of the river, ready to cross over and to go in, or they were ready to enter into that land. And they sent spies out to spy out the land. In Numbers chapter 13 and verse 31, the men who had gone up with Joshua and Caleb said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature." And so they say in verse 33, "Therefore we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, so we were in their sight." Now notice in chapter 14 and verse 1, "So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, 'If only we had died in the land of Egypt, if only we had died in this wilderness, why has the Lord brought us to this land? To fall by the sword that our wives and children should become victims. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?' So they said to one another, 'Let us select a leader and return to Egypt.' Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation, the children of Israel. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, 'The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. And if the Lord delights in us, He will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them.' And all the congregation said to stone them with stones." That is the spirit of fear, and it is the fear of man, and it conquered the children of Israel there. Every accountable adult, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb, died in the wilderness. Now, this record does not tell us. Certainly Moses and Aaron and Miriam was not a part of this unbelief, but nonetheless, they died in the wilderness as a result of some other things that happened there. Only Joshua and Caleb had overcome that fear of man among the people of Israel. It's a real thing, and I think that we've experienced it. There's things that we're afraid of in this very same regard. And it's something that the Lord warns us about and tells us that we've got to get past. But it's a fear that is not just among those that we would have no respect for. And we look at the children of Israel and we see how Joshua and Caleb handled it, and we think, wow, you know, Joshua and Caleb, that's the spirit of Christ. And it is. They had the spirit of David before there was a David. Maybe David actually had the spirit of Joshua and Caleb. But what I want you to realize is that while Joshua and Caleb did the right thing there, there's some other very good men that didn't always possess that spirit of David, that spirit of Joshua and Caleb. I want you to notice with me in an example in Genesis chapter 20. In Genesis chapter 20, beginning in verse 1, the Bible tells us there, "And Abraham journeyed from there to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and stayed in Gerar. Now Abraham said of Sarah his wife, 'She is my sister.' And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, 'Indeed, you're a dead man because of the woman whom you've taken, for she's a man's wife.' But Abimelech had not come near her, And he said, Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Did he not say to me, she's my sister? And she herself said, he's my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocence of my hands, I've done this. And God said to him in a dream, yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart, for I also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet. He'll pray for you and you shall live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all yours. So Abimelech arose early in the morning, called all his servants, told all these things in their hearing. The men were much afraid, and Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us? How have I offended you, that you've brought on me and all my kingdom great sin? You have done deeds to me that ought not to be done. Then Abimelech said to Abraham, what did you have in view that you've done this thing? Well, listen to Abraham in verse 11. Abraham said, because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife. But indeed, she is truly my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. And it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, this is your kindness that you should do for me. And every place where we go, say of me, he is my brother. He's the one that put her up to that lie. And I know technically it wasn't a lie. It was deception. And it was just as sinful. It was just as wrong. What preceded that? What brought about Abram to have the lack of faith, to have this deception in his heart? The spirit of fear. I want to tell you, the spirit of fear brings out the ugliest in each and every one of us. And this fear of man is exactly one of those things we see in John chapter 12 and in verse 42. That among the rulers, many of them believed in Jesus. Nevertheless, because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. They were afraid of being put out of the synagogue. This is something that is real. And it's something that great men of God have failed in. So when we find ourselves battling with that, we don't need to beat ourselves up so much that we think, well, I can never be pleasing to God. I can never be successful as a servant of God when I'm struggling with this fear of man. Look at Abraham. I'm so thankful that God reveals times in men's lives like he does with men like Abraham and David and others. Men like Moses. Because it helps me to realize that I can come back from failure. It makes me realize that every time that I may feel that I've had a shipwreck, that I'm not completely lost. I can come back from it. Abraham did. David did. Other men who failed. But what it does help me to also realize is that if I think that I stand to take heed lest I fall. Because if Abraham can fail in regard to the spirit of fear, then certainly I can too. And I don't care how far I have progressed, how mature I am, I've always got to be on guard for that very thing. And we need to be aware of the realness of this as well. The challenges for each one of us is definitely there. Not only with Israel and Abraham and the Jewish rulers, there is a challenge for each one of us. That fear of rejection. What keeps us from sharing the gospel and the truth with people that we work with people that we go to school with? Is it not that fear of rejection? We know very well that if we are to share the truth with them and they realize what God's word has to say about their soul, there is a very good likelihood that they are going to get angry about it, that our relationship will be forever changed. There will be a certain rejection of them toward us. And it could even impact others. You know, when we're young and we're at school, one person rejects us and other people follow suit and do the same thing. Now that fear is real. The fear of being made fun of, peer pressure, the fear that people will harm us, the fear that something's going to happen. And that's not just physical harm. I mean, certainly Paul was afraid of that in the city of Corinth, and I can understand why. And there are places where the gospel is being preached where people have to fear physical harm and persecution like that. But sometimes we may fear that others will harm us, not in the sense of taking us out and scourging us or being beaten with rods, but We fear harm of maybe our business or reputation being ruined. Maybe losing our job, not getting that promotion or something else like that. That kind of fear affects us many times. The wife of a harsh, unloving husband who is trying to intimidate her so that she will not go and worship or give to the Lord. These are real things that Christians deal with. The parent of a child who is suffering for being different. Maybe a child is not going to the prom and not dressing immodestly, and so they're being made fun of. And parents are afraid of their child suffering. As a matter of fact, I think for many of us, we have greater fear of our loved ones suffering than we do of ourselves. Is that not right? I can handle persecution a lot more than I can handle seeing my wife or my kids go through it. So these are the challenges that we face. An employee asked to participate in a sinful activity. Now that fear of man is real. And there's also the fear of failure that I think is something that we have to deal with. It's not just the fear of what someone else is going to say or do or how they're going to respond to us, but it's just we're afraid that if we try that we're going to fail miserably. And what are we going to look at like? You know, how is that going to impact our other relationships? I want you to realize that this fear of failure is really an inferiority or an insecurity that affects us. You know, fear is most often the result of a personal state of inferiority or personal insecurity. When we talk about inferiority, the way it's defined is an exaggerated sense of inadequacy, which leads to insecurity or a lack of confidence. Did you notice that? An exaggerated sense of inadequacy. I think that we all realize that in certain areas of our life, we possess certain inadequacies. There's some areas where I realize that, hey, I'm going to have to do this, but I'm not real good at this. And we might ask for some help with it. Or maybe we work together with some other people and we say, you ought to do that because you're a lot better at that than I am. Well, sometimes we're not there and we've got to step in and we've got to do something and we recognize our inadequacies. That's a normal thing. As a matter of fact, you need to know what you don't know. A person who doesn't know what they don't know is a person that's not going to be very effective or very successful. So there's nothing wrong with knowing our inadequacies, but inferiority is a whole different animal. That is an exaggerated sense of inadequacy. And that's something that some Christians have. That's something that probably all of us have struggled with in various ways. And that's when it becomes dangerous for us. And we've got to overcome that or we will not have the confidence to do what the Lord would have us to do. It's a state of feeling inferior to another person or feeling inferior to a job or a task or a duty. And the problem is that then it fosters this feeling of defeat and of fear instead of rising up to face the challenge and gaining confidence. We can have confidence being aware of the fact that we may not get everything just right. We can have confidence knowing that we may not do a thing perfectly, but we're going to do it the best we can for the Lord. That's okay to have that kind of awareness. That's self-awareness. There are far too many people out there in the world that have no self-awareness, and I don't particularly enjoy being around people like that. I don't know about you. They just don't seem to realize how obnoxious they are or how transparent they are and some of the ways that they handle themselves. I don't enjoy those people. We need a self-awareness. We need a healthy and a sound mind of being able to see what God has for us. I want you to look with me at what God says about this over in Romans chapter 12. Turn over to Romans chapter 12 and notice when he's talking about offering our bodies a living sacrifice. Then he goes on in verse 3 and he says, "For I say through the grace given to me to everyone who is among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each a measure of faith." And then he goes on to talk about, as we have many members in one body and not everyone does the same function, and then he talks about using what we have. So obviously I'm going to be aware of what I don't have. And he's saying you need to be that way. You need to think of soberly about things. That means you need to have a self-awareness. You need to know your inadequacies. But thinking soberly about yourself also means that you are not going to have an exaggerated sense of these inadequacies. That you're going to realize that it is not just you involved in this, but that God is the power that's going to work through you. That is thinking soberly. And when we're able to do that, we're going to be able to accomplish something. You know, this problem of inferiority and insecurity, it is that electric fence syndrome. I tried it once and I got shocked. I'm not going to do it again. We've got to, you know, try again, as the old adage goes. We've got to realize that if God gives us a challenge, gives us a task, a responsibility, then He knows that we're capable of it. That doesn't mean that He believes that we're capable of doing it perfectly. Have you ever noticed in the book of Judges that the Bible tells us that when God sent the children of Israel in to drive out the Canaanite nations, that some of them had chariots of iron and they were obstinate and they wouldn't be driven out? Well, what's up with that? I thought God said that He was going to drive the people out, that He was going to give them the power and the ability. He did. He didn't say that He was going to drive them out like that. He even said, I'm not going to do it all in a day. I'm going to give you time to populate and to fill this land in. But here's what God was telling them. I want you to go and drive them out. And if you run into something and you can't push them out, then I want you to gather yourself and I'm going to give you some more strength and you go fight them again. And if they won't be pushed out, I want you to gather your strength. I'm going to give you more power and you push them out again. What God was saying is, this is just the way it works, and we need to understand that too. You've probably heard some of the old time preachers preaching about using the illustration about the farmer that when he had the old plow and his mule and he'd go out and plow the field, and there was an old stump out there in the field, and every time he went by that stump, he'd hit it with a plow and he'd go on around it. And the next year he'd hit it with a plow and go on around it. And pretty soon that stump came up. He didn't pull it up in one season of planting. But every time he hit it a lick with that plow, and pretty soon it came up. That's what we've got to understand. The inadequacies, thinking soberly, the power of God, and we're going to give our best at something. And we're going to do it better the next time and better the next time. But all of this is overcoming that problem, that electric fence syndrome. I tried it once. I'm never going to try it again. And I want to point this out too. That having an exaggerated sense of inadequacy is not humility. Humility is a sober mind. It is being aware of our place before God. In Proverbs 30 and in verse 8, the wise man said, give me neither poverty nor riches. I would say, give me neither inferiority nor pride. Those are both extremes. And both of those will destroy us as God's children. You know, there's quite a number of examples of people who limited themselves and their service because of the fear of failure. Moses is one that we can think of in Exodus 4. Remember in verses 10 through 14 where God told him to go and tell Pharaoh to let his people go, and Moses kept saying, I'm not a good speaker. I can't tell him anything. God said to Moses, who made man's tongue? God was saying to him, I can make of you whatever you need to be. I'm the one that gave the ability to speak. And if I'm sending you to do something, I will give you the power to do it. What about Gideon? In Judges chapter 6, we find Gideon who fails in this exact same way. And in Judges chapter 6, in verses 14 through 16, the Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours. You shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you? So he said to him, oh my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh. I'm the least in my father's house. And the Lord said to him, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man. I want you to see that God will not make something out of me without my effort. That's what we see in Gideon. God's not going to make something out of me or you without our effort. But God will supply everything that we need. The one talent man in Matthew 25, in verses 24 through 25. What was the problem with the one talent man? Well, in verse 24, The Lord said, he who had received the one talent came and said, Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you've not sown, gathering where you've not scattered seed. And I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours. Here again, we have that spirit of fear. The fear of failing the challenge. He was afraid that he might mess things up. He might mess up the investments. He might lose what his master had given him. And so he did nothing. The fear of failing the challenge. The fear of not being able to do whatever God has called you to do. And I want you to think about how many lost opportunities come as a result of this fear of failure. Teaching a Bible class. How many Christians have never taught a Bible class because they're just afraid? They're just afraid that they can't do that. What about teaching a ladies' class? Do you know in so many churches how difficult it is to find older women who will actually do what the Bible commands that they do in Titus chapter 2, which is to teach the younger women? And I know that many times they say, well, they don't want to hear what I have to say. Well, as I told other people, bless your heart, they don't want to hear what I have to say either. We still preach the Word in season and out of season. That goes as much for older women teaching younger women as it does for me or Joe or any other gospel preacher. Amen? And so what we've got to do is, instead of looking at that saying, well, I can't do that, we've got to see a challenge, see the responsibility given to us, and say, I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to hit that stump with that plow. I'm going to do the best that I can do. You know, none of us are necessarily going to be a dynamo at everything that we try to do for the Lord. And you know, it's not that necessarily that the Lord's telling us He's going to make us the best that ever was, but He's going to make us adequate. He's going to give us the power to do what we need to do. Men, what about starting or leading a young men's study? Or just a men's Bible study? You can't imagine how much that will impact the unity and the strength of a local church when men come together. I'm not just talking about in the adult class out here. I'm talking about finding a time during the week when men can come together and just study with each other, sharpen each other like iron, and talk about the things that's going on. They can share some of these things with one another. You learn, you grow in patience for each other. You grow together in unity, not only in matters of faith, but even in matters of judgment. You come to be able to appreciate different views on certain things, and you have patience one with another. Those things have to be started. They have to be led. You know what is going to happen sometimes? It's going to fall apart. People are going to quit coming, and you're going to have to start up another one a little bit later. And then maybe a bunch of people quit coming, and you've only got a few people left, and then you're going to have to try to breathe life into it again. I mean, that's just the way that things like this go. But don't be afraid of failing in that way. How many people will not lead a prayer because they're just afraid that they won't do a good job with it? How many people don't show hospitality? Not just to their brethren, but to visitors and strangers. Wouldn't it be wonderful if every visitor that came to a congregation were invited to go home or out to eat with someone, that no one ever left there without being invited, so that we can at least help them along with their way? Why don't more people do that? Fear is one of the reasons. I'll tell you another area is husbands who feel inferior to lead in their family. I see it way too often. And sometimes, you know, maybe in the relationship, in the marriage relationship, just in the chemistry, the wife is just more assertive. She's more outgoing, and maybe she just has some natural talents and qualities as far as leadership go. And the husband, for varying reasons, he just is intimidated by that, or maybe he didn't feel like he had a good example, and he's afraid of failure. He's afraid if he goes out there and makes a decision on this, and that he's going to fail. Nobody's going to like it. Admit it, men. Why do we ask our wife, or if you're dating your girlfriend so many times, where do you want to eat? Where do you want to eat? And our wife says, I want you to decide. Make a decision. You say, yeah, every time I do, she doesn't like it. Hey, go with it. I mean, that's a really innocent thing. The difficult The difficult ones are where you've got to be able to look out there in your family and see that your children are going in the wrong direction. And maybe sometimes you and your wife don't agree on this. That's why God said that you are the head of the house. You've got to have the objectivity to be able to make those decisions. But there's so many men that are afraid of failure, and so they just relinquish the leadership of their home. They gladly give it over to their wife, and if she fails, then he has nothing to be afraid of. That's cowardice. And if that's where you are, don't get married. If you're already married, then man up. And like I said, I'm not trying to make someone ashamed if they've struggled with fear, but what I am telling you is that cannot succeed, and you can't go to heaven if you're not leading in your family. So reach out to other men here. But above all things, turn to the Lord. Turn to His Scriptures and pray for the courage to make the right decision and the wisdom and the guidance. And God will give it to you. He promises in James chapter 1 that if you trust in Him and if you need wisdom, ask Him and He'll give it to you. Man, there's just not enough husbands and fathers that are taking that time on their knees, that prayer time to seek that guidance. And I've failed in this as well. Just making decisions that I thought were best, but not spending enough time in prayer before I make those decisions. Hey, that's a recipe for disaster. You ought to be afraid of making those kind of decisions because it is scary being a parent, being a husband. But this is where we lose opportunities. And many times these fathers are seeing their children grow up and leave the home, and then they see all of the problems that are there because the father was not the leader in the family. And it's too late. You can't get the reins back. You can't go back and change that experience in their life. You may be able to change the leadership in your home, but you've missed that window of opportunity. We're living in a time. I know that there was a generation, maybe even in my childhood and certainly before I was born, when there was a problem of men that were abusive and they would browbeat their wives, and they were Attila the Hun in the home, and a lot of our class books had to be written teaching men how to love their wife. But we're living in a different time now, men. I want to tell you the problem I see by far in our society is men who will not be authoritative in their home. And we're going to suffer the consequence of that. God forbid that godly men and members of the church are failing in that way. And these opportunities are being missed. And there are some opportunities that only come to you. I want you to look at David and Goliath and to realize that sometimes there are opportunities that only come to you. You are the man or the woman of the hour. And God is saying, you got this. You know, when Paul said that he was set for the defense of the gospel, I used to think that word set meant like in football, you know, down set hut, you know, that he was, you know, locked and loaded. He was set. He was ready for the defense of the gospel. That word set, what that word means is placed where he was. What he was saying is God has put me here. When we read the book of Philippians and we see all the people that were taught when he was in prison there, he said, you know what, this has turned out good. How did that happen? You think God's working providentially in that? Paul said he was. He was set. He was placed for the defense of the gospel. And I want to tell you, David was set for the defense of Israel. And you have been set for the defense of the faith. You have been set for the restoration of some saint, or for the salvation of some sinner. You've been set for the influence of someone who's looking up to you. Each and every one of us has an opportunity, but are we afraid of it? In Ezekiel 22 and in verse 30, God said through the prophet, I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land that I should destroy it. But I found no one. No one to stand in the gap. So many lost opportunities. How are we going to overcome this fear, though? This is the practical side of it. How do we do that? I want to tell you, it begins with fear. But it begins with the fear of God. the fear of God. In Matthew 10 and in verse 28, you remember as Jesus spoke to His disciples, He said to them in Matthew 10 and verse 28, "Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear Him who's able to destroy both soul and body in hell." He said, you know how to get over the fear of man? Fear God. Fear God. If we will think more about the judgment of God, we will think less about the judgment of men. That's just a fact. And so overcoming that, that's why Proverbs 1 and 7 says, "The fear of the Lord's the beginning of knowledge." Have you ever played that game? Would you rather, you know, would you rather jump off the house or run through that fire? Boys do some really foolish things, you know, when they're younger. Would you rather? But essentially, we need to ask ourselves, would you rather face man or God in the judgment? Would you rather? That's an easy answer. And that's what Jesus is calling on us to consider. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and in verse 11, so much so that the Apostle Paul would say, "Knowing therefore the terror of the Lord, we persuade men." When we're talking about the fear of God, the word phobos is the word that's used. That's not just all in reverence. Phobos, from which we get phobia, it's terror. The terror of the Lord. We can have a loving God and still understand the magnificence of His power and truly be in terror of that judgment and that punishment. Fear God, and then don't fear man. The psalmist in the 27th Psalm and in verse 1, the 27th Psalm and in verse 1, "The Lord is my light, my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" Again and again, the psalmist warns us or exhorts us not to be afraid of what men can do. Again, the 118th Psalm in verse 6, "The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do to me?" What this is all about is having the proper perspective. You know, sometimes, depending on distance, somebody who's close to you can look very large and somebody far away looks very small until they come into perspective with one another. You see, David didn't compare himself to Goliath. He compared Goliath to God. That's having the proper perspective. That's overcoming the fear of men. And that's really what I want to encourage you to do. When you fear that fear of men that we were talking about earlier, what men can do to us, how they can impact us. We can lose our job, or we can lose our house, we can lose this, or they can do this to my kids, and all kinds of things like that. God can set a hedge around you too. He's destroyed armies of thousands upon thousands without a sword being drawn. The battle that Gideon fought, the trumpets and the pitchers and the torches. We think that the destroyer of God going out into the valley and destroying thousands of God's enemies. Why do we fear man? We need to understand that God is on our side. We need to remember those wonderful examples of courage that we have. Like Joshua and Caleb, we are well able to take this land. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In Daniel 3, in verses 16 through 18, I guess their actual names were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, but we know them with their given names, their Babylonian names. But still, they tell the king, "Our God is able to rescue us. And even if He chooses not to, we're not going to sin." Those are examples. Esther, in Esther chapter 4, and in verse 16, she simply said, "If I perish, I perish." She knew what she had to do. She had come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And so as she went and approached the king, she said, "If I perish, I perish." But the apostles in Acts 5, verses 28 through 30, and when they were released after being beaten, the Bible tells us that they prayed for more boldness. Courage, brethren, is not the absence of fear. We see that Paul was afraid at times. Courage is not the absence of fear, but the determination to act in spite of it. That is the spirit of power and of love and of a sound mind. The spirit of fear takes us hostage. The spirit of fear causes us to react the wrong way, but the spirit of power is not that we're never going to be afraid of anything. It's that we're going to react to that fear in the right way. How do we overcome it? We need to fear God. We need to see the examples of courage. And we need to also add to our faith what the Bible calls virtue. 2 Peter 1, in verse 5. Add to your faith virtue. Why is that one of the first things that we read about? Because virtue, as it is defined, means literally manly morality. That's what virtue is. And women can have it too. That's not gender specific, but obviously the Bible understands that when we think about acts of heroism and bravery in warfare, we think about being a man. The Bible even says, act like a man. Be a man in these things. He's talking about bravery and courage. And so this word virtue means manly morality. Not that a woman is acting like a tomboy. It means that even women, a virtuous woman in Proverbs 31, she's showing that heroic and courageous faith that she had. So when he tells us that we need to have that virtue, that's manly morality. It's the courage to live according to your convictions. Paul would write in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 13, watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. Add to your faith virtue. That's courage. That's the courage to live according to your convictions and realize that you are never alone. You know, that's what David was stating in 1 Samuel 17, verse 37. He said, the Lord delivered me out of the paw of the lion and from the paw of that bear, and He'll deliver me from this man. And when he approached to Goliath in verse 45 through 47 in 1 Samuel 17, he told Goliath, the battle's the Lord's. The Lord is going to destroy you. He knew that God was with him in that valley. And that's why he ran, not away from Goliath, but he ran to Goliath because he knew that God was running with him. Paul would say in 2 Timothy chapter 4, speaking about some of the very difficult times in his life, in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verses 16 through 18, Paul said, at my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me. May it not be charged against them. Listen to verse 17. But the Lord stood with me and strengthened me so the message might be preached fully through me, and that all the Gentiles might hear. Also, I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion. Isn't that interesting how he goes back to Daniel? He makes an allusion back to Daniel. I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion. Who was there? Who was there with Daniel in that lion's den? It was the Lord was with him. The Lord was with Daniel's three friends. And Paul realized that God was with him. We are never alone. You know, in Genesis 15, after Abraham had gone and rescued Lot and his family from those rebels that had come through the cities of the plain and taken them hostage, I am so impressed that Abraham, you know, you think about him as just, you know, being a man of sheep, you know, and he obviously had these herdsmen out there. But did you notice that these herdsmen that herded sheep, they also had another skill? They were trained men of war. Abraham had some trained soldiers that worked for him. And he had them all gather their weapons and go with him. And he defeated those armies. But what's beautiful is when he gets back, God speaks to him in Genesis 15 and verse 1. And he said, Abraham, I am your shield. We need to remember that when we're afraid. God will never leave us nor forsake us. He is our shield. He will stand with us. And when we can be aware of that, that has to be real, not just a memory verse. But that's going to come through reading these stories, looking at these examples of faith. It's going to come through prayer, much prayer to God. And then, let me suggest also, pursue righteousness. Pursue righteousness. I say that because righteousness essentially means being right with God. In 2 Timothy 2 and verse 22, we're told to pursue righteousness. Run after it. Do everything in your power to gain that reality that God has approved of you. That you've surrendered anything you need to surrender. You've repented of anything you need to repent of. That you've acknowledged whatever you need to acknowledge so that you can know if the Lord came back right now, He would be thrilled to call my name because I'm right. I'm good with Him. You know, I was talking the other night about how nothing could, especially as a young man, could make me feel 10 feet tall any more than knowing that my dad approved of me. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. That courage, that confidence that we're good with each other. God's good with me. That's righteousness. And in Ephesians 6 and verse 17, he speaks about the helmet of salvation. That's what he's talking about. You're bulletproof. When you know that you're right with God, you've got that courage. Nothing scares you because God is pleased with you. He's going to be with you. And I believe that to a large degree, for many years in my life, when I struggled with the fear of men and the fear of failure and this insecurity or inferiority, in most cases, it's because I knew, like the rich young ruler, there was still something that I wasn't willing to give up, and therefore I knew God wasn't with me. It wasn't a failure on God's part, it was a failure on mine. That's how we overcome fear. This problem of insecurity, not feeling secure with these things, this goes hand in hand to a large degree. This is overlapping. But I want to suggest to you, we need to pray. When we're feeling insecure with things, we need to pray. You know, in the book of Nehemiah, he had this ragtag group of builders, and they built the wall around Jerusalem in 52 days, record time. But I want to tell you, almost every time we are introduced again to Nehemiah, he is praying somewhere. Every problem that comes up, remember when Sanballat and Tobiah were making those threats and people were telling him they're going to come when we're not looking and they're going to attack us at night? What did Nehemiah do? He prayed. He prayed to God. In Hebrews 4 and in verse 16, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. We need to study God's Word, 2 Timothy 2 and verse 15, to present ourselves approved to God, what we were just talking about in pursuing righteousness. And then we need to apply ourselves to whatever it is that needs to be done. In 1 Timothy in chapter 4, I want you to notice Paul says to Timothy in verse 12, let no one despise your youth, but be an example to believers in word and conduct and love and spirit and faith and purity. Till I come, give attention to reading, exhortation, and to doctrine. And look in verse 15. Meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them that your progress may be evident to all. Apply yourself. 1 Peter Chapter 1, or 2 Peter 1, verses 5 through 11. Add to your faith, virtue, diligence, love. Build yourself up. As you're growing, you're going to overcome that insecurity and have the proper thinking. As we talked about, think soberly. Think soberly. You know, in Romans chapter 12 and verse 3, we need to think soberly. In Proverbs 23 and in verse 7, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. That doesn't, don't be prideful. Don't be self-absorbed. But think of your way in a sober-minded way. And I want to tell you that prayer and study will lead to properly thinking about things, seeing things in the right perspective. Quit comparing yourself to other people. In 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12, he tells us that when we compare ourselves with ourselves, we become fools. We need to constantly compare ourselves to the Lord. When we compare ourselves to others, it only results in inferiority and false confidence. And one of the things that's happening so prevalently today is we're spending way too much time on social media and seeing the image that people are portraying that's not real in the first place and thinking that we must be inferior to them. What we're seeing isn't real. What social media shows us isn't real. But I want to tell you, if you don't value wealth, if you don't value physical beauty, you're not going to feel inferior about those things, are you? If you lay up your treasure in heaven, if you value things that are eternal, if you value inner beauty, you're not going to feel inferior. You're not going to feel intimidated. Yeah, you need to quit comparing yourselves to others, and you need to realize who your Father is. In 1 John chapter 3 and in verse 1, he says, "Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called the children of God." You're a child of God. He's your Father. He will never leave you or forsake you. He will not give you a serpent or a scorpion. We've got to realize He's going to give us those good things. Realize who your Father is and realize that the power to do great things is in God. It's not in you. The battle is the Lord's. 1 Samuel 17 and verse 47. He doesn't need our greatness. He needs our willingness. He needs our faith to be His conducting rod. That's really all we are, is a conducting rod. You know how something conducts electricity? It doesn't generate it. The electricity doesn't come from a conductor. A conductor just passes it through. And that's what we are. We're the conducting rods of God's power. He doesn't need our greatness. He needs our cooperation, our willingness, and our faith. God can accomplish anything that He desires through anyone who will simply serve Him. David had a sling, a staff, and 5 smooth stones, and he defeated a giant. We need to have faith in God to make us what we need to be. The psalmist in the 46th Psalm in verse 1 said, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble, abundantly available. I want to appeal to you, brethren, pray. Pray to God. Search for your niche or your natural abilities and let those be your anchors for your pursuits. Yes, we need to realize that the spirit of fear is a tremendous giant that is rising up to try to destroy each and every one of us. He may have already taken you captive. But I hope tonight you've realized you don't have to be a captive of fear. You can conquer it. And you can conquer it in just the way that the Bible has outlined as we've looked at. If you're here this evening and you've never obeyed the gospel of Christ, then what you have to fear is your decease or the Lord's return, because you stand in eternal jeopardy right now. You need to come to Jesus tonight, believing in Him as the Christ, the Son of God, the Savior of your soul. Confess your faith in Him as such publicly. Repent of your sins and be baptized in water, baptized into Christ unto or for, in order to have the remission of sins. That's what we're told, Acts 2:38. Why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. Acts 22:16. You can do that tonight. All things are ready. We're waiting for you to make that decision. And if as a child of God, then you realize that you've let fear conquer you, then make that known to God and seek His forgiveness and make the changes that you need to make tonight. Whatever your need is, won't you please come while we stand and sing the invitation song.